Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, where Geoffrey Lehman makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute on the occasion of the publication of his memoir, which is called Geoffrey Lehman, Leeward, a Memoir. Now, he's well known to many of you. He's an unusual combination of a prominent lawyer and a prominent poet. And, of course, Geoffrey Lehman won the Prime Minister's Literary Award for Poetry in 2015 for his collected poems. And he's also an author and, of course, most recently of this book. So welcome to Geoffrey Lehman. Lehman is going to talk for us on the topic Arguing with Family Ghost, the Unsafe Memoir. Geoffrey, thank you.
The title of my talk was chosen by Anne and Jared, so I'm compelled to talk to the title of the talk. When you've lived in the same city as I have for 78 years and lived nowhere else, the landscape is filled with ghosts. They crop up everywhere. My wife Gail and I recently visited the house of a friend in Walker Street at the head of Lavender Bay to watch the Luis Buñuel film Viridiana. I grew up on the McMahon's Point side of Lavender Bay, looking across at Luna Park, so I was immediately surrounded by ghosts. In the 1880s, my German grandfather, a carpenter, built a house on stilts, Queenslander style, with a workshop underneath in Walker Street, North Sydney. That is North Sydney, not Lavender Bay. Walker Street in Lavender Bay is an extension of the same street, but it is now bisected by the Pacific Highway and a railway line, so it is chopped into two, like a lizard that has given up its tail. They are effectively two different streets, joined only by a name. When I was a child, my Aunt Agnes and her brother Carl were still living in my grandfather's house in Walker Street, North Sydney, as opposed to Walker Street, Lavender Bay. By the 1940s, my grandfather's house was falling apart because my Uncle Carl was a carpenter, like his father, and wouldn't allow any other tradesman to work on the house. The Walker Street house had a large sunken garden with a stream running through it, crossed by a small bridge resembling the bridge in Monet's garden. There were fruit trees, bamboo, a spreading poplar, grapevines. For me as a child, it was a magical place. In 1974, as a solicitor, I acted for my aunt, then aged 90, on the sale of her house to a developer. She died the day after the sale was completed and the house was immediately demolished. In the 1880s, when Walker Street was actually one street, my grandfather, Johann Ernst, could walk with his Welsh wife, Annie, who had been a domestic servant before she married, on Sunday mornings down the street to attend a service at Christ Church, the Anglican Street in Walker Street, at the head of Lavender Bay. The church's rector in 1891 had been Alfred Yarnall. He was the secretary of the Australian Board of Mission, which organised for the first Anglican mission to New Guinea in 1891. I imagine that sometime in the early part of that year, that's 1891, he preached a sermon talking about the need for workers to go on a mission to convert the heathen, and my grandfather was in the congregation and agreed to go. In August 1891, my carpenter grandfather began building the mission station at Dagura. That means cannibal battleground in the Wadawan language. A couple of months later, he contracted malaria and died the day after he got back to Walker Street, North Sydney. His doctor upbraided my grandmother, Annie, for trying to keep her husband alive. She should have let him die in peace, she was told. But Annie had four very small children, and she was pregnant with my father Leo, who was born a few months later. Alfred Yarnall and Frederick Felton, the hardware store owner who founded the company that later became Knock and Kirby, were the witnesses on Johann Ernst's layman's death certificate. My grandmother Annie was given some money by the Anglican Church, but when she asked for more, Alfred Yarnold wrote back saying, "I received your letter this morning, and I regret very much that you were so unwise as to write it." In this way, the family of a pious carpenter became unbelievers. His eldest daughter, Agnes, was not educated past primary school level and worked most of her life in a steam laundry, but became a proud member of the Rationalist Society. This fact was unknown to me as a child, as my family never discussed religion. We regarded ourselves as typical Protestants. The essence of Protestantism was that you were wholesome and tolerated every sort of religious belief except Catholicism. There were basically two religions. On the one side, there were the Protestants. They included Anglicans, Presbyterians, Methodists, Congregationalists, and so on, but also Jews, atheists, Muslims, Hindus, and Buddhists as well. They were all Protestants. Then, on the other side, there was the second religion, the Roman Catholics. So it was that as a child I was sent to Anglican schools, first being Church of England Preparatory School, Mosman Prep, and later Sydney Church of England Grammar School, Shaw. My headmaster at Mosman Prep was A.H. Yarnold, otherwise famous as Tibby Yarnold. No one in my family seemed to notice that Tibby had the same name as Alfred Yarnold, who had lured my grandfather on the mission to New Guinea, then witnessed his death certificate. In fact, Tibby was Alfred Yarnold's son. Although Yarnold Sr. was one of the malign actors in my paternal family history, Tibby, his son, turned out to be my first great benefactor. In my final year at Mosman Prep, he gave me and another boy special tuition in Latin in the hope that we would get scholarships to Shaw, which we didn't get. And he inspired in me a great love of ancient mythology, giving me as a prize Gerber's Myths of ancient Greece and Rome. He also said to me, "When you get to Shaw, make sure you study ancient Greek." Tibby and I never discussed my grandfather and the obscure connection we had. He was by then in his late 70s, and I was a callow 11-year-old. I was certainly unaware of the link, and I have since wondered whether he was aware of it, that I was the German carpenter's grandson. In 1952, when I started at Shaw, I said, "I want to study Greek." They said, "We don't teach Greek, but we teach German." So I thought, why not? German was my grandfather's language. In this way, I became a student of German, and the poetry of the great German poet Rainer Maria Rilke became one of the great loves of my life. So I became a German scholar because I wanted to learn Greek, one of life's many accidents. A few months ago, I translated 50 of Rilke's rhymed poems into rhymed English, and I'll read one of these poems at the end of this talk. When Gail and I were on our way to the Buñuel film, I noticed the greenery around Christchurch Lavender Bay was much lusher than when I was a child. As well as being the church where my grandfather's funeral was held, this was the church where my sister was baptised in 1936, when she was a few months old, by the Reverend Dr. Frank Cash, the Reverend Alfred Yarnold having joined the saints in heaven by that time. 4 years later, I was born in the depths of winter, when World War II was raging, and my parents somehow forgot to get me baptised. I clung tenaciously to this unbaptised status, which I saw as a great asset, a form of religious virginity. And I always rejected any suggestion that I go to Sunday school. One afternoon, at the age of 10, I was looking out of the dusty window of an old fibro laundry at the sky. This was in McMahon's Point. It was my last year of living there. I was wondering whether a cloud would go across the sun. I forget now whether the cloud passing over the sun meant there was or was not a god. I didn't wait to see what happened. I decided I did not need a cloud to help me make up my mind. There was no God. I had now joined that denomination of Protestants who called themselves atheists. In fact, I was following a family tradition without realizing it. Some moralists of the old school say that atheism is glib, divorce is an exercise in self-indulgence, and the decision to undergo an abortion is capricious and no different from murder. These moralists may have good intentions, but I think it is glib to say people are glib about such decisions. Sometimes we come to a critical fork in the road, and we see two paths ahead, as in the Robert Frost poem, The Road Not Taken. When we choose, few of us take the decision lightly. Michael Kirby, when he launched this book a few weeks ago, Centre for Independent Studies, talked about the enormous pain he experienced as a young man when he realised he was homosexual and decided to act on this. As a child, it was enormously painful for me realising I was an atheist. Before that decision, there was the possibility of someone up there, even if it was just a possibility. Afterwards, there was no one with a capital N. Becoming an atheist at the age of 10 was not something I talked about. At Mossman Prep at the end of the year, I was chosen to read the lesson from the Bible to the assembled parents and boys and the regular congregation at St. Clement's Mossman on Sunday morning. I told no one I was an atheist and was proud to read from the scripture with all the enthusiasm of my boy soprano voice could muster to a congregation of several hundred adults and children. So far, I've talked about my paternal ghosts. They are the usual mixed bag that most of us have in our family. Yes, there was tragedy, but somehow they survived and made a go of it. I have no argument with any of them. But for most of my life, I haven't had an argument with my maternal ghosts. These were ghosts from my mother's side of the family. And they have made Leawood an unsafe memoir. Remember, I was talking to the title. My argument began when I was either 10 or perhaps 11 years old. We had just moved from Lavender Bay, then a slum area, to Gordon in Sydney's North Shore, a far more respectable middle-class suburb where my mother, Iris, was no longer ashamed to live. In my first 10 years, my mother had been my great supporter. She gave me books to read. She encouraged her love of classical music and opera and plants. My father loved botany also, in a rather more discriminating way than my mother, despite his more rudimentary reading. But until the age of 10, I was a mother's boy. She even said to me one day, "You should become a lawyer and a writer." Years later, I dutifully followed the instructions she gave me as a child. But in 1951, all of this changed. As I said, we had just moved to Gordon. Next door, there was a girl called Helen. That was her name, and I hope she's still alive. She was the same age as me, 10 or 11, and we were both extremely innocent. We started playing together. We just talked and ran around as children do. I don't remember what we did, but we both greatly enjoyed each other's company. I thought this was wonderful. I was at an all-boys school. I had never known a girl of my own age. Our friendship was exciting as the moment when I found I could swim by myself in deep water. One day, I came home from school, and my mother had a grim announcement for me. She said, "You're not to play with that girl next door, and I've told her mother that too." I was stunned. I never spoke to Helen again, although we often passed in the street in the years to come. I was an obedient child, but I had come to a fork in the road. I began walking down a road away from my mother. I never looked back. Even at that age, I partly understood why my mother acted as she did. I don't remember when I first heard the full story of her childhood from her, but I may have been 10 or 11 when she first told me. In 1906, at the age of 10, my mother, her brothers and sister, and their mother had just been reunited with William George Rayner, their father, in Eidsvold, a remote gold mining town in Queensland. William Rayner had become the town's resident medical officer. They hadn't seen him for about 9 months. A short while after this reunion, my mother heard her two parents arguing. The following morning, my mother found her father dead on a couch in his white silk suit, as she put it. He had died from a morphine overdose. That was the central fact in my mother's life, and why she was afraid of life and couldn't bear the thought of my being friendly with the girl next door. She wanted to possess me. She was uninterested in the man she had married, my father Leo. I was to replace her lost father and perhaps an older brother whom she had lost in World War I. It was not a role that I wanted, but it was thrust upon me. The great American poet Wallace Stevens has written a poem, Esthétique du Mal, and in this he wrote, "The greatest poverty is not to live in a physical world, but to feel that one's desire is too difficult to tell from despair. Perhaps after death, the non-physical people in paradise, itself non-physical, may by chance observe the green corn gleaming and experience the minor of what we feel." My mother didn't live in the physical world. She was one of the non-physical people. I think I was one of them also, until I was about 35. I finally escaped at the end of my first marriage, yet another painful fork in the road, where a choice had to be made. One of my reasons for writing Leawood was to check the precise chronology of the events in 1906 and my mother's later life, to resolve my argument with ghosts. What I discovered became a terrible indictment of my maternal grandmother, Isabel Mooney, who liked calling herself Bella, although she was known to her family by the plainer name of Bell. I now believe Bella's willfulness drove William to suicide. As a child, I used to hear about William Rayner's alcoholism and his occasional taking of morphine. This caused him to move from one medical practice to another until his bad habits caught up with him again. That was my mother's version, which she received from her mother. It was true in many respects. Despite all this, my mother loved her unreliable father passionately. But was he the only one at fault? I have only one letter written by William. It is in clear, modest handwriting, unlike the chaotic and swashbuckling script of Bella, which is hard to decipher. In it, he asks succinctly and warmly to rejoin him with the children. He had now moved to Eidsvoll. The people liked him there. He had good prospects, and he hoped she would enjoy it once she got used to it. He was a realist. He realised Eidsvoll might seem unattractive at first, very rough and ready. The letter is clear and rational. I have some of his clinical notes from that period. Again, clear and methodical. He had survived in Eidsvoll for several months, with nothing untoward apparently happening. Yet within 6 days of Bella arriving, he was dead from an overdose of morphine. I think it is clear to me now, perhaps clearer than when I wrote Leawood, that this was suicide. Bella told William she didn't like the idea of life in Eidsvoll. He had run out of options, and so he overdosed. Bella's subsequent history is woven from the same substance. She was mad about kings and queens and dukes and duchesses. She kept massive books of cuttings about the lives of the aristocracy while sending her children off to work, my mother to a sewing factory, her eldest son to work as an agricultural labourer in Gippsland, while she remained at home and cut out newspaper stories about the rich and famous and checked their genealogies in her Whitaker's Peerage. I had this book once and threw it out in disgust. Sometime in the late 1920s or early 1930s, Bella uprooted my mother from the life they had together in Melbourne, and they moved to Sydney. The reason why Bella did this was that her eldest surviving son, Billy, had moved to Sydney, and Bella could not bear to let him escape. As a result, my mother was torn away from another brother and a sister and their children who remained in Melbourne, and also numerous cousins and friends. My mother's social isolation in Sydney, which was engineered in Bella, may have been why my mother married my father, a man she didn't love. In my mother's words, she married my father, Leo, because he was, quote, safe. Safety was not something she had as a child or had from her own mother. In writing the memoirs, I became aware of a final act of bastardry by Bella. When I was born, my sister Diana was 4.5 years old. and reasonably easy for a woman in her mid-70s to look after during the day while my father was at work. Diane was a practical and compliant child. Bella lived in the flat just a few blocks away from my parents. My father probably paid Bella's rent. Bella was not senescent. She loved playing the piano. I can remember her playing it when I was a child. But it seems she didn't offer to help when I was born. Instead, Diana was sent off to a children's home for several weeks while my mother, who was turning 45, recovered in a hospital from birth. My sister remembered this abandonment for the rest of her life, but didn't seem to realise it was Bella's fault. I only realised when I started writing the memoirs. In Buñuel's film Viridiana, which Gail and I saw at our friend's house in Lavender Bay, the blonde and beautiful novice nun Viridiana tortures herself with a crown of thorns. She then gives up the idea of taking vows and becomes the benefactress of a group of beggars. But she is still, to quote Wallace Stevens, one of the non-physical people. Viridiana's beggars break into a great chateau owned by Viridiana and her cousin. They stage a dance resembling Da Vinci's Last Supper, while Handel's Hallelujah Chorus is playing from a record player, and Viridiana arrives unexpectedly on the scene. When one of the beggars tries to rape her, she comes to her senses. In the final scene, her handsome cousin, to whom she is attracted, asks her to join him and his mistress in a game of cards, as Ashley Beaumont is singing Shimmy Doll, again from a record player. Viridiana hesitantly accepts, at last joining the physical world. A ménage à trois is implied. After the screening of Viridiana, my host suggested that on a future visit, we may do a little bit of archaeological investigation further down the hill to see if we could discover the footings of the House Leawood, which was the house where I was born and was on the shoreline, the head of Lavender Bay, and burnt to the ground in the late 1940s. I said earlier in this talk I would finish by reading one of my recent translations from Rilke, a poem called The Garden of Olives. Rilke himself did not fully live in the physical world. He vacillated about it. And Jesus, one of the non-physical people, is one of Rilke's alter egos. The poem begins with Jesus climbing the Mount of Olives and desperate as he comes up into the olive grove. In the second verse, he starts speaking. I'll indicate this by signing some inverted commas in the air. I'll make more signs for inverted commas when 10 lines later, Jesus stops speaking. After Jesus stops speaking, Rilke, in his own voice, refers to scripture, which claims that an angel came to Jesus in the olive grove. But did an angel come? Rilke suggests the scriptures are wrong. No angel came. It was just an ordinary night. In fact, angels wouldn't be interested in visiting a selfless person like Jesus. The final electrifying lines still jump out of the page more than 100 years later, and some translators omit the last shocking line, which I'll of course be reading in my translation. Rilke's poem, published in 1907, is one of the greatest of the 20th century and is as brutal as Buñuel's Viridiana 50 years later. But there is a difference. The novice Viridiana, who is played by the famous Mexican actress Sylvia Pinal, is never more than attractive, blonde, flesh and blood. Pinal is still alive now, in her late 80s, has been married and divorced four times and had four children. The Jesus of Rilke's poem is a perfect human being. He may lose his belief, but he keeps his faith. He is transcendent. That is a message for all of us. And this is Rilke's The Garden of Olives, the translation I've just done. So he walked up under the grey leaves, now quite desperate and grey in those dry lands, and exhausted rested his dust-streaked brow, cupping it in his hot and dusty hands. After everything, this and this, the end. I must go now, although the way is blind. And why do you command I must pretend that you exist, you whom I cannot find? I cannot find you, no, not on my own, and not where others go, not in this stone. I cannot find you, now I am alone, alone with all the suffering which I came to lighten, bringing comfort in your name. You who do not exist, O nameless shame. Stop speaking. Later, or so it said, an angel came. But why an angel? What came was the night, and rustled through the olives, unconcerned. The disciples slept, and sometimes one turned. It was, when it came, a quite ordinary night. Nights like this happen everywhere. Dogs sleep, and stones lie there. And the man praying could be anyone waiting for the morning sun. The angels do not answer such a prayer. Such nights are hardly big enough for them. The selfless ones will find no rest or room. They are the sons that fathers will condemn, and mothers will eject them from the womb. Rilke had a troublesome relationship with his mother, not something I'm unfamiliar with. That completes my talk on a double negative and a preposition.
Many thanks, Jeffrey. Now we've got some water for you. You can either drink it or we could do an adult baptism if you want. I'm sure someone here should be able to help.
This is not baptism.
Now, well, it could have been. Thanks for that. We've got some copies down in the back at Jeffrey Lehman's Leeward, a memoir, which I'm sure the author will be happy to sign after the event. So now we come to questions and discussion. I was going to ask the first question in classical Greek, but I'm sure not everyone here went to shore. I don't think so. So I tried in English. How hard is it writing about the dead as against the living? I mean, you've said some pretty tough things about your mother, and she's not around to defend herself. So how hard is it to write that? And how does it compare with writing about Les Murray, for example, who also gets quite a run in your book? Just come back here.
Yes. Well, I think that's why a lot of memoirs are written by people towards the end of their life. In that you can write in a fairly uninhibited way and try to work out what happened. Also, I think that you want to tell the truth. In my case, it had to be an unsafe memoir because of the things that happened to my mother. On my father's side, that's a fairly standard collection of difficulties and tragedies. But once I started to write about my mother, I had no choice other than to tell the truth. I could have tried to lied it all and forget it all, but that's not what I like doing. Some people who are deceased have had their names changed because they had living relatives, and I didn't, or perhaps had living relatives, I wasn't sure, and so I left them out. I left their names out, and obviously with one or two living people, I didn't mention the names. With some of these people, I actually discussed whether they wanted to be named, and they said no, they didn't.
And Les Murray, how is it right about Les?
I don't know how Les would feel about this. He's not very well at the moment, I might add, but that's happened since I published this or wrote this memoir. But Jared, you might be able to answer that better than I can.
Before we do that, tell us what you said about Les.
Well, Les and I were very good friends for about 20 or 30 years. And then he published a very savage review of a book of mine, Nero's Poems, in of all places, the Catholic Weekly. He was obviously, which is hardly what you'd call a literary magazine, but this was a very long and very unfavourable review. And he was obviously getting a lot of dirty water off his chest, but I felt it was I didn't greatly appreciate it. Again, this is one of the advantages of writing memoirs, is it never occurred to me. One of the poems that Les disliked most was a poem in which, a long poem, in which Nero describes murdering his mother. And Les's mother died when he was 10 or 11. And so he never actually had the experience of moving away from his mother, as many young men do eventually. So he treasured his mother, and I realised in the course of writing the memoir that that was probably the sticking point with Les when he was doing this review of Nero's poems, because I've forgotten the exact lines in the poem, but the poem about Nero murdering his mother finishes off something like, "Leaves you, Nero leaves you, drowning mother, not your boy." And Les never stopped being his mother's boy because his mother died when he was a child. And so that was a realisation that I got, one of the many realisations that I got from writing the memoirs. So if you ever decide to write your memoirs, you might discover a whole lot of things about yourself that you didn't quite understand, because when you set these things down, that everything gets put into perspective and you suddenly think, ah, so that's what really happened.
Right, thanks. So on we go to, there's a question here. I'll just get a microphone in there. Okay. You give us earlier notice.
Do you get as much intellectual satisfaction out of text planning as you do in writing poetry? And then may I ask you, in your view, who's the greatest Australian poet?
Well, I'll answer the first question, the last question first, which is, I think that Les Murray is probably Australia's greatest poet. So my argument with Les is not an argument about his poetry. Now, do I get as much pleasure out of tax planning as out of writing poetry? Obviously, the answer is no. I certainly did. You see, as a young lawyer, I really just did law, and I became a solicitor because I wanted to get married and have children and lead a normal sort of life. So I had to make my money somehow to survive. And so that's why I became a lawyer. But I was wary of becoming a barrister because I thought that a barrister's life would be too demanding and that would interfere with writing poetry. So I set my sights fairly low, and I had very poor undergraduate degrees in law, in second year law and third year law and fourth year law. I got as many posts as it was possible to get without repeating. That meant I got one post in second year law, another in third year law, and two. They allowed you to get two posts in fourth year law. And I didn't have to repeat, and I still graduated. So I thought I would never, ever become a legal academic, but I sold my law firm in the mid-1970s for various reasons and became an academic, and I suddenly had this absolutely terrible degree. And so I was going to have a very difficult time progressing as an academic with this very spotty undergraduate degree. So I was told that taxation law was a difficult area for academics, and so that's how I became a tax lawyer, and that ultimately led to my becoming a partner in an international accounting firm. But what I really love about tax is the policy side of it rather than the tax planning side of it. Certainly, I helped clients with tax planning, but I also got onto a number of government bodies helping with reform of the tax law, and I have a lot of sympathy with the current commissioner who came out of a large accounting firm, as I did, but I came out of a large accounting firm to start writing when I was 68, and he went from KPMG to the tax office. But Chris Jordan I greatly admire as a human being. So tax policy really was what I fell in love with rather than tax planning as such. And for about 10 years, I wrote a regular article on tax for the Australian newspaper. As a result of that, I became familiar with a lot of arguments about what taxes work and what don't. And I refined my ideas about tax, so I think I understand it now. But certainly when I first started writing about tax for the Australian, my views on tax policy were a lot less sophisticated than they'd be now. Basically, with tax policy, what matters is purity, and you can simplify it down to that.
Hello, Mr. Lehman. You probably don't remember me from about 50 years ago when you taught me tax, and I queried you about the complexity of the Tax Act and how difficult it was to understand, and you agreed. What would you do if you had a clean slate now to simplify our taxation situation? And do you agree with the proposed Labor amendments?
Right.
We usually have topics broadly on the topic. This is not... Well, it could be a ghost, I suppose, so there you go.
Yes, it is a ghost. Yeah. Ghost from my past. In my memoirs, I talk about the Tax Law Improvement Project, which at first I thought was a waste of time, because really all it did was rewriting the Tax Act in simpler language. But I changed my mind later on, and in fact the Tax Law Improvement Project was in fact a very well worthwhile thing, because it put all of the definitions in one place in a dictionary at the end of the Act. And oddly enough, the Tax Law Improvement Project, because it improved the language in which tax law was written, allowed the writing of a great deal of very complicated tax legislation. They wouldn't have been able to write such complicated tax legislation if they hadn't simplified the language in which it was written. So that's an irony on an irony. Now, after TLP, or TULIP, came in, as they called it, yet a further attempt at simplification was made, which was called the tax value method. And that was an attempt to just completely change the Tax Act and turn tax into something resembling accounting principles. And I thought, being a partner in an accounting firm, I thought, oh, this is absolutely wonderful stuff. The tax value method was the greatest thing since sliced bread. Anyway, as draft legislation came out, I began to realise just how complicated it was. The basic rules, the core rules in the Tax Law Improvement Project legislation were 16 pages. In the tax value method, they'd expanded to about 80 pages, because tax value method was introducing all sorts of strange concepts, basically based on accounting concepts. So I got the job of writing the report on which the tax value method, which I'd approved of at first, I got the job of writing a report on why it should be abandoned, and I wrote a 52-page report for the Board of Taxation saying that the whole thing was a dog. And Dick Warburton shook my hand as I was leaving afterwards, that Secretary of Treasury Ken Henry was there, and the Commissioner of Taxation, this type of thing, and they all listened. So I discoursed on why it was no good. And Dick Warburton shook my hand as I walked out and said, look, you talked me into believing in the tax value method, but now you're against it. So that was my experience of simplification. What I do believe is this, that there's no point in trying to simplify. What is complicated about tax legislation is setting up compliance systems. You can have very complicated drafting, and even the Tax Law Improvement Project, our drafting of the legislation, there are hundreds and hundreds of pages of legislation, but they're all very precise and pedantic rules, and you've got to set up complicated systems to deal with them. But once the systems are set up, the whole thing just works fairly automatically. So the minute you try to simplify everything, you create a whole new wave of complexity, a whole new wave of compliance systems has to be set up. My view is leave it well alone. There are certain parts of the Act which I would get rid of. I would get rid of the debt, the ways in which you determine what is a debt and what is not a debt. I think that's all rubbish. But essentially, I would just cut out vast swathes of it, but not really try to change the basic provisions.
We're going to take your advice, and after this, we're going to leave tax well alone. Question here.
Yes, Geoffrey, you were saying that you were a non-physical person and that there was a change when you were 35, but I was trying to reconcile that with your career as a poet and the world of the senses, which is very much a part of the poet in being in touch with the senses and expression of the senses, and that seems at odds with the description of yourself as a non-physical person. I wonder if you care to comment on that.
Yes. Well, let me quote again from Wallace Stevens. The greatest poverty is not to live in a physical world, to feel that one's desire is too difficult to tell from despair. So what Stevens is saying is that instead of actually enjoying things, you think about them all the time. And that's what a lot of poets do. That's, in fact, what Rilke did a lot of the time. Rilke never really lived in the physical world. He got married for about a year or so, and then just abandoned his wife and his child and had various relationships and never really settled down to anything. I think that we have to live in the physical world. It's hard to explain, but Stevens explains it as perhaps after death, the non-physical people in paradise, itself non-physical, may by chance observe the green corn gleaming and experience the minor of what we feel. So some people enjoy everything in their heads, and other people go out and actually enjoy themselves in their bodies. And so this is what we all need to do. We need to enjoy ourselves in our bodies and not just enjoy ourselves in our heads. I don't know whether one can explain it in any more, in any greater detail.
Thanks. Godfrey, I'm fascinated, like everybody else here, and gripped by your description of your childhood. If you'd, instead of going to Mossman Prep, you were at Maris Brothers Mossman, and things, your parents were Catholics, what sort of career would you have projected for that and share that with us?
Right, well, I think if I hadn't committed suicide, I don't know what I would have done, but I would have had a much more disrupted childhood than I had. Because the great thing about... I describe myself as an Anglican atheist. I'm not an atheist. I'm an Anglican atheist. But I mentioned this to Stephen McInerney, who's very much of a Catholic. And he said, oh, Graham Greene used to describe himself as a Catholic atheist. But I think the Anglicans are probably much more at home with Anglican atheists than the Catholics are with Catholic atheists. I think I would have had a very, very difficult time.
There's a question up there.
Yeah. Geoffrey, do you regard writing your memoirs as an exercise in self-discovery or more of an exercise in communication?
Well, John, with most things, one doesn't like to say whether something is more than or less than or equal to. For me, it was both. Basically, the history of it was that I was in the process of finishing my collected poems. I didn't really expect to write any more poems, and my wife, Gail, suggested that I write some memoirs. So I went ahead and started writing my memoirs. And it was an exercise in self-discovery, but it was also an exercise in communication, in that one wants people to read one's poetry, and so by writing some memoirs I created a text out of which people could read my poems. So it was really both, but I did discover a few things about myself that I hadn't realised before.
Discussion up the back.
Geoffrey, Clive James, I think it was, called his unreliable memoirs, and it seems that writing your memoirs is perhaps dangerous. You're setting yourself up, perhaps, in some ways. I remember a woman who read Jill Kerr Conway's Road from Kerrang in London and threw the book across the room at how she treated her mother, whereas I read it and thought, you know, what a marvellous story, and I missed that bit entirely. How hard is it to be objective? And we've had stories down through the decades of maybe two sisters of the one mother having completely different versions of what happened in their house. We have that now with child abuse as well. So how do you do it? How difficult is it? And are you setting yourself up a bit?
Thanks, Anne. You do set yourself up when you write memoirs. As a matter of fact, about 4 or 5 years ago when I started writing these, I had an email correspondence with Clive, and he said, oh, you want to be very careful when you start writing memoirs. That was his experience. And in fact, a friend of ours here is one of the unnamed characters in Clive's unreliable memoirs. He was at primary school with Clive. Yes, you do expose yourself once you start writing memoirs, and I think you decide either to expose yourself completely or not at all, and I decided on complete self-exposure. Janet Malcolm, for example, about 3 months ago had an article in the New Yorker where she had a lot of photographs from her childhood, including some of her photographs of parents and so on. And then she made the comment that she wasn't going to vent all of her childhood grievances. I've forgotten the exact phrase. So she obviously decided to write a safe family memoir, but presumably she didn't have any argument with her family ghost. She, you know, there were tragedies that happened and various things that happened, but there wasn't anybody to argue with. So that was an easy choice for her, to write a safe family memoir. I had to write an unsafe memoir because the minute I dipped my toe in, I was dipping it into water with a low pH level, and there was going to be a lot of acid in it. And so you make your choice and you go ahead with it.
So thank you very much. My question is just taking further the tension between the inward non-physical and the physical dimensions, and just coincidentally looking at print of Streatham's painting The Purple Moon's Transcendent Might, the subtext says that he was immersed in reading Schelling while he was painting that picture, and that he was fascinated by the inward vision, the inwardness, if you like, the non-physical and mental dimensions of Shelley's poetry. And tracking it, discovering that Shelley at the age of 10 decided that he was an atheist and got into big trouble at school with Ethan for writing an essay on why I'm an atheist and so on. And yet in pursuing the physicality of his life and calling, it just turns Frankensteinian and horrific, and it ends in horror and terribleness and whatever. So it's really just asking for a comment on whether perhaps the work of art itself, the poem or the painting, resolves the tension between the non-physical and the physical, or okay, puts something in the physical world.
Okay. Yep. Shelley, you'd have to rank as one of the most non-physical of all poets. I think radiance stains the whatever it is of eternity. I've forgotten the exact word, exact phrase. And he certainly was a very non-physical poet. And I think there is a real problem for people who sort of disdain the physical world. I think that's something that's going on a lot in campuses at the moment with identity politics and this type of thing, that people are finding that they have identities rather than just being their complicated real selves. And history seems to go in cycles of people being living in the physical world and then living in the non-physical world. Perhaps we are going through a period of non-physicality at the moment, where people become obsessed with ideas. Certainly Marxism was the Marxists lived in a non-physical world that had nothing whatsoever to do with reality. And interestingly, Wallace Stevens, one of his great poems, really is about the Russian revolutionary, Victor Serge. I think it's in that poem, long poem, Asetik Gemal, where he talks about Victor Serge and Konstantinov. I used to imagine that they were both invented characters until I found out that Victor Serge really was a revolutionary and wrote one of the most marvellous books of the 20th century, Memoirs of a Revolutionary. So we perhaps are going through a non-physical phase at the moment. That's where the dial is pointing now, and then the dial on the compass will swing back to people living in the real world.
We're getting close to the end. In your notes at the back of the book, you refer to Les Murray, who you've discussed tonight, and to Clive James, who you've briefly mentioned tonight, but you also refer, of course, to Christopher Brennan, who is, I guess, better known in Sydney than he is elsewhere, and, of course, Judith Wright. So what are your memories of those two?
Well, of course, I didn't know Christopher Brennan, but I was really passionately fond of Christopher Brennan's early poetry from quite a young age. Brennan's The Wanderer, I think, is one of the great poems in the English language. And what I think is interesting about The Wanderer, which I think is the greatest fin de siècle poem in the English language, far greater than The Ballad of Reading Gaol by Oscar Wilde, what's interesting about The Wanderer is that it's recognisably set in the northern beaches, of Brennan walking around up in those hills overlooking Collaroy and Newport and places like that, and of being driven by the wind and looking at the sea and so on. And that's one of the things that makes it such a great poem. Of course, I didn't know Brennan because he died, I think, in about 1932, 33, forgotten the exact year. Judith Wright, I knew quite well. She stayed at my house, and I've stayed at her house, and Gail, my wife, knew her daughter well, and we still do know Meredith, friends of Meredith's. But I was a great admirer of Judith Wright, and again, she was one of my favourite poets when I was at school and later on, and I eventually got to know her, starting off as an admirer and then getting to know her personally.
Okay, now we forgot. Have I missed anyone? So there's one down the front. Okay, just speak up.
Jeffrey Jeremy Kinross.
Yes.
Is there any problem in releasing My Old Electorate, the address of your home in Gordon, or generally the addresses on the North Shore? I just have a personal interest. And could I ask two ghost questions? One, you to me in 78, when I think I first came across you, haven't changed much at all. What's your secret? And second ghost question, quickly squaring this, I should have read it or bought it before when Michael Kirby, my first boss, launched it. Why didn't you talk as much about New South Wales, my alma mater, undergraduate, as much? Was it the fact that you were with three children, just alone then? Was it the fact you were an accidental lawyer? and or was it the fact that I always perceived you then, quite young at 18, 19, as a creative man, a bit of a fish out of water in the Faculty of Commerce?
Now, we'll just make that the final question, just for those who are listening outside. So I guess the point is you've written about Sydney University where you're a student, but not so much about UNSW where you're an academic, right?
Okay. Yes, yes. Well, I think that when you're writing memoirs, you tend to write about the earlier years rather than the later years. Nick Hasluck told me that his mother was absolutely mortified that she, Lady Hasluck, received no mention at all in Sir Paul's memoirs. But his view was that a gentleman wrote about his childhood and youth in his memoirs and he didn't write about anything else. So that's probably one of the reasons why I don't go into a great deal of detail about University of New South Wales. I was at that stage, particularly early on, I had shared custody of three small children and my life was a bit chaotic, and I was trying to establish some... I was trying to be a bit reputable as a tax lawyer, so that took a little bit of time.
And are you going to give the addresses of your home addresses in Gordon, isn't it?
Well, yes, because the person who bought my house in Gordon no longer owns it, and he was somebody I went to school with, Tony Addison, and that house was 4 Burgoyne Street, Gordon. And I don't know who owns it now, but Tony bought it from my sister and me back in early 1970s. And the houses in McMahon's Point, all of the numbers of those houses changed. So the main house we lived in was 51, and next to that was the very large house, 53 East Crescent Street. But those numbers were changed. Then the houses were demolished. And as I look across from the train, I can see where they were on the waterfront and the large apartment block that replaced them. It has been demolished yet again. And a new apartment block is going up on the site. So that's they've all gone. When we sold those houses, because the new owners were worried about potential heritage orders, the bulldozers moved in literally the following day.
I think that's a very appropriate place to end on. The bulldozers moving in. Look, many thanks, Renato. I'll be very brief as usual. We've started off around the time of Jeffrey's birth and we've ended up discussing Google Maps, so we've come a long way. Look, thanks for a very fine presentation tonight of what's an interesting and... I think your word is, for your memoir, is, what was it again? What particular...
Unsafe
memoir. But you've certainly been unsafe tonight and quite revealing about yourself and your family. And so, as I said, there's copies of Jeffrey's book, Leeward, down the back, a memoir. I'm sure he's happy to sign it. And thanks for a great presentation tonight and good luck with Leeward.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.